Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner.
And I'm Anthony McCarthy.
And this is... Go ahead, Anthony.
No, please. And this is the Mark Steiner Show. We have just a packed 2 hours with information, a lot of questions we hope that have been on your mind, have been on Mark's mind and my mind when it comes to the United States Senate. Mark, why is it that everything we read, whether it is a commentary or if we're reading about the politics of the Senate, it appears that this 60-vote threshold is the new get for the Democrats? And it's really disturbing in some ways because a lot of people are saying, look, Democrats have a huge majority. Why aren't they using it better? Well, we're blessed to have someone on who's going to explain the history of the Senate to us and possibly why this 60 has come to mean so much.
So this first part of our program, we're joined by Donald Ritchie, who is the Senate historian. And Linda Monk will be joining us as author of the book, The Words We Live By, Your Annotated Guide to the Constitution. Donald Ritchie, welcome to the program. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you.
So, first, before we jump into it, tell us about your job.
Oh, it's a wonderful job, actually. I tell people I have a front row seat for the best show in town. I'm a professional nonpartisan staff member of the Senate, and so my office has been in existence since 1975 and has never had a political appointee and has never changed with the majorities. So we serve both parties, and we serve the public, we serve academics, we serve anyone who's interested in asking questions about the U.S. Senate.
And so, okay, so your job is really a job. Your job is more for the public than it is for the senators themselves.
Well, the senators call here. The staff members call. We get calls inside the institution, but we spend a lot of time talking to journalists, and we get people who are curious about something they saw on C-SPAN, and they call the Capitol operator. And if the Capitol operator can't think of any place else to send them, they forward them to the historical office.
So this is the question I think that a lot of Americans are just trying to figure out, and I'd like to let you begin, and we can maybe talk some of the politics of some other guests as well. I mean, most Americans cannot fathom, and I must say I'm maybe one of those at times, why a 59-vote majority by the Democrats and their independent allies is not enough to hold sway in the United States Senate in 2010. Mm-hmm. Has something changed?
Well, you know, it's funny. Ever since the very beginning, people have wondered about the U.S. Senate. And there's a story about Thomas Jefferson when he returned from France after he was minister that sat down with George Washington and asked why they created a Senate in the new Constitution that they'd done with one body legislature under the Articles of Confederation. And supposedly Washington said to him, well, we created the Senate for the same reason why you pour your coffee into your saucer, to cool it. And the idea of a second house is to cool it down and to slow it down. If they really wanted a very efficient parliamentary type of government, they wouldn't have created a Senate in the first place. Just have a big majority-run House of Representatives, and that would take care of it. But the authors of the Constitution were very afraid of the frenzy of public opinion, and they used to use the word frenzy, that there would be great shifts one way or the other. And they wanted one body to really reflect what the people were thinking at the moment. That's the House of Representatives, where everybody runs every 2 years. They wanted another body that was removed from the political pressures and would stand back and would think things through, and that's the U.S. Senate. And the U.S. Senate has frustrated and complicated things for presidents and speakers of the House and majority leaders for the last 200 years, but that's essentially what the authors of the Constitution had in mind for it.
Donald, this is Anthony McCarthy. I have a question for you about not so much the politics of it, but I think that a lot of people wonder about the idea that the United States Senate passes these rules. I guess what Mark and I want to get to is this fixation by us in the media, by the public, and by the political parties on this magic number to control the Senate.
Right.
Are there differences in the rules of the Senate that are essentially written by the senators and their staffs and passed, and the powers they're given in the Constitution?
Well, the main power that applies to this case is the Constitution says that each House of Congress will write its own rules. And very early on, the House of Representatives, which is a big body, wrote rules to allow the majority to get its way, to just cut through all the problems. And in the House, as long as the majority party sticks together, it really doesn't even have to talk to the minority party. But in the Senate, the rules have always given more voice to a minority, not necessarily the minority party, sometimes a minority faction within the majority party, sometimes even a minority of one. A single senator stands up and says, "I object," and everything stops, and everyone turns around and says, "Well, what is it you object about? What can we do?" And so every U.S. senator has individual powers in ways that practically no one in the House of Representatives, except maybe the Speaker and a handful of committee chairmen, have.
We're also joined, along with Donald Ritchie, who is a Senate historian. I'm really happy we have him on the air. It's a treat to kind of be able to understand this with a man who has that position as a noted historian. And we're also joined by Linda Monk, who's written many books, including The Words We Live By, Your Annotated Guide to the Constitution. She used to be a regular guest on the show, and now she's back again. Linda, good to have you back.
Hi, Mark. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Can you hear us?
Okay, good. I was worried. I was trying to get a word in there.
wanted
to point out that the Constitution that, you know, we enforce today is not the same one that the framers wrote. In fact, the Senate, as they designed it, would not really have been directly accountable to the people. It was chosen by the state legislatures for. So, you know, we need to recall that we, the people, have changed how the framers set up that original Constitution from time to time. Also wanted to point out that the Supreme Court has ruled, in fact, that under the terms of the Constitution, that a quorum is what the Constitution requires to do business. So that, in fact, if senators wanted to change the filibuster rule, they could change that by a quorum doing business. And I think the reason the filibuster survives is because both parties find it useful when they're in the minority.
So, Linda, are you connecting? This is very good. This is, I'm surprised at how excited I'm getting by all of this. But are you saying that this 59, but it was 60 for the longest time since the last election, that the Democrats really were focusing on, they got their party really jazzed up about, give us this 60 margin, this 60 vote majority, and then we can really get business done. Really, they don't need 60. They just need to in the rules.
They do under the current rules of the Senate, as I'm sure our historian would would concur. The question is, what would it take to change those rules?
Okay. Mm-hmm.
The Supreme Court won't intercede on whatever each house does for itself because it does have the constitutional power to set its rules. What the court has said is that a quorum of each house is what's necessary to change. Within that quorum, who's to say whether it's a majority or 60 votes, you know, in terms of changing the rules themselves? The other thing I want us to keep in mind is we talk about majority, majoritarian, as though that somehow correlates to, you know, a majority of Americans or so. And we need to remember the Senate itself is not a majoritarian body.
Right.
You know, we have two votes for California
That's
with lots
right.
of people
mm-hmm.
and two votes for Wyoming with not very many people at all. So it's not like it becomes useful to the political parties so that they can get things done, but it's not like a majority in the Senate correlates with a majority in Americans as it does with the House, where a majority of the House definitely represents a majority of the numbers of Americans.
Linda Monk is with us with Anthony McCarthy and I, and this is Mark Steiner. She wrote the book, The Words We Live By, Your Annotated Guide to the Constitution. And Donald Ritchie is with us, who is the United States Senate historian. The number here is 410-319-8888. Join us here with your thoughts on the U.S. Senate, the way these things are being held up in the Senate, your own frustrations about it, how this fits into the rules of the Senate and our laws and the Constitution. 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. So, Donald Ritchie, I'm curious, what Linda Monk was saying, tell us a bit about the history of how these votes have gone to change the rules in the United States Senate over the years.
Yes, believe it or not, 60 is a great reform over what we had before. Until 1917, there was absolutely no means in the rules of the Senate to shut off debate. We had unlimited debate, known as filibusters. In 1917, President Woodrow Wilson got so furious about a filibuster that involved arming U.S. Merchant ships just before World War I that he called the Senate into special session, and he demanded that they create a cloture rule. And they, because of the war feeling at the time, they followed suit, and they created one, but it was a two-thirds vote of the Senate. And two-thirds is almost impossible to get in the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
So for years, for decades, majority leaders practically never filed cloture. And when they did, they practically never achieved it. And for years, filibusters were used mostly by Southern senators to prevent any form of civil rights legislation from passing. In 1964, they actually achieved cloture after the longest debate in the Senate, 57 days over the Civil Rights Act of 1964. They got the two-thirds vote, and they got the vote to pass the bill. And that took civil rights off the table. Segregation was no longer the issue that they were filibustering about. And so pretty much at that point, everybody felt they had the right to filibuster. in 1975, this is right after Watergate, 1974, there were a large number of liberal Democrats who were elected in the House and the Senate. And they led a movement to try to reduce the vote for cutting off a filibuster to a simple majority of 51. And the senior senators, and included a lot of liberal senators, people like Mike Mansfield, who was majority leader, said, well, that would make the Senate just like the House, and there is a reason for us to be different. And we need,
to
stop and stand back and have a second opinion on these things. And you need to have the ability to stop things that you think are really wrong. So the compromise between the two sides was to reduce it from two-thirds to three-fifths, or 60. And that's what we've had since 1975, and that's affected the tactics, the legislative tactics that take place that both parties have adopted, and why 60 has become sort of a magic number. But actually, it was a reduction to make it easier to end filibusters when it was brought into place in 1975.
So,
I think one of the problems has been, though, that it's become where all you have to do is threaten to filibuster to then take things to a cloture vote. And one person that I've heard make a good recommendation is Cliff Sloan, who used to be the editor for Salon, and he said, let's go back to the old days where you actually had to filibuster. And, you know, bring out the cots, let the people, now that we've got C-SPAN, let the people see
the process.
Who are being the obstructionist.
That's, of course, it's an old Mr. Smith goes to Washington view that people should stand up there and talk. But, of course, these are U.S. senators we're talking about, and they actually love to talk. And if you gave them unlimited time on C-SPAN, they would have no trouble filling it up at all. And, in fact, majority leaders came to the conclusion that kind of all-night sleep-in-the-cot filibusters wore the majority down faster than it wore down the minority, that the minority just needed a handful of people to be around to hold the floor. The majority had to keep the quorum of 51 there. And after a couple of nights of sleeping in cots, members, you know, were beginning to think maybe they should take this bill off the calendar and send it back to the committee. In fact, in December, we had pretty much close to that old-fashioned filibuster. The Senate was in session 7 days a week. They were voting at 1 o'clock in the morning.
That's right.
7 o'clock in the morning. And it really was. And, you know, frankly, not many people around here want to do that very often. it's a tiresome process, and it doesn't always lead to the end that you want. It's not something you want to trigger too easily.
I'm Anthony McCarthy. You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show. We're talking with Donald Ritchie, the Senate historian, and Linda Monk, the author of The Words We Live By, Your Annotated Guide to the Constitution. I want to ask about the rules again and this idea that a lot of senators, we watch C-SPAN, we think we understand. Here lately, the president, his nominee to the TSA, some other sub-cabinet positions have been put on hold. Donald Ritchie, Linda Monk, can you explain how a senator has the power, one senator,
right,
has the power to put a nominee on hold?
Well, there's nothing in the rules about hold.
Oh, at all?
Not even mentioned.
Really?
And a hold is really just the opposite of a unanimous consent agreement. And the Senate actually does a majority of its business by unanimous consent. And little things like allowing a whole speech to go into the record as if the person had read the whole thing. Big things like passing a whole bill by unanimous consent. And that means everybody agrees. They've worked out all the differences in the committee. They can bring it up and they can move it through. And that majority leaders use that to expedite business. But that means anybody, any single senator, majority or minority party, freshman or senior senator, can object. And everything stops. So the majority leader wants to, at that stage of the game, find out if he brings it up by unanimous consent, would anybody object? and that's what a hold is. And they put aside the controversial issues that have holds on them so they can move the non-controversial items through. Majority leaders don't want to give up the hold to some degree because they want to know. They don't want to stand up on the floor and get lambasted by an objection to a unanimous consent agreement that they hadn't anticipated was coming.
Donald Ritchie,
is that another rule that's kind of morphed beyond its original intent in the sense that originally it was supposed to just delay a vote? I mean, delay a sense of, well, I'm not going to be there on the floor or whatever, and now it's become just this, you know, absolute block. Is that correct?
Some people use it. They use it for different reasons. Not all holds are designed to kill something. Sometimes a hold just means a delay. A senator wants a chance to read the entire bill. Senator Metzenbaum of Ohio was not on the Finance Committee, and he put a hold on every tax bill so he had a chance to just sit and read them before they came up for debate. Yet other people who put a hold on a nomination because they want the nominee to come to see them and answer questions that they have. They have others who want to get an amendment on the bill to make it better, they feel. And then there are others who use it to absolutely kill the bill. And Senator Jesse Helms of North Carolina was famous for using holds against legislation, against nominees that he hoped would never be passed in the Senate. So there's a variety of uses that happen in there. Of course, at any point, the majority leader can say all holds are off
and bring up
whatever they want, but that means that they're going to have to go through the lockdown, dragging out the procedure because the person who's got the hold is most likely going to object to unanimous consent agreements, which often suspend the rule so you can do things faster.
Now, Linda Monk, I'm just curious, as you observe this and as a historian of the Constitution and the way our government works in the Senate and the House, as well as being a lawyer, what your thoughts are about how this process is working now. I mean, I've heard people argue that the way the Senate was formed with 13 colonies, making sure that smaller states had, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, Donald Ritchie, the smaller states had more of an equal say in where this new American nation was going. So Delaware and Rhode Island wouldn't be swamped by Massachusetts, Virginia, New York, Pennsylvania. With 50 states, has that dynamic changed in terms of how the deliberations go in terms of the arguing and fighting for the future of our country?
Well, it's interesting because it's the equal representation of states in the Senate is one of the few things that's in the Constitution that says this specifically cannot be amended. So if we're going to stick with our current Constitution, it's one feature we can't get rid of. And I think the variations of population have made stark those choices that were made, but I think they're not choices, they're choices in degree, not kind, meaning that I think we have such a strong tradition in America also of anti-majoritarianism, like our Bill of Rights, that there's certain things that shouldn't be subject to a majority vote. I think that's why we haven't gotten rid of the Senate or gotten rid of the Constitution sooner. It appeals to a certain balance that that's part of the American psyche from our founding, that yes, we want majority rule, but we want minority rights. And the best argument for filibuster is that it preserves a sense of minority rights.
Donald Ritchie, how long have you been the Senate historian?
Well, I've been in the Senate Historical Office since 1976 as the associate historian. I've really only been the Senate historian for the last year as my longtime colleague retired.
Okay.
But I've been here doing this work for a very long time.
That's a good job to have. it is, for somebody who loves this, is a passion for this work. 410-319-8888. We want to get a couple of callers in here if you want to join us to talk about what's going on in the Senate, because I think part of the issue here is that what's been hyped in the media and talked about in the media a great deal is how this process really may, on the one hand, be considered deliberative, but how it's really functioned is obstructionist and not being able to get things done. That people are talking about America facing these huge issues that we have to address, whether it's health care or the economy and the rest of it, and we're stuck with a system that will not let us move ahead. Now, is that reality to do with you?
We're not stuck. I mean, that's where I feel like we really do have to hold our elected leaders responsible. And if you take, this is a Supreme Court ruling in 1892, 2, U.S. versus Ballin, where it says essentially the Constitution requires you to have a quorum to do business. Once you have a quorum to do business, the Supreme Court's not going to ask any more questions. Mm-hmm. So if the filibuster is such a big problem, then the people can put pressure on the Senate to change.
Right. Well, of course, we have a quorum here. We have to have a quorum to do any business in the Senate. That means you have to have a majority of the members present. The question is whether or not that majority can call for a vote. And the idea of a filibuster is to prevent the majority from ever getting to a vote.
No, I understand that, but how could the filibuster rule be changed?
Well,
the question
actually
is, do you have to have 60 votes to do that, or can you?
It actually requires even more. To change the rules of the Senate, it requires a two-thirds vote of the Senate, so that'd be 67 senators.
Huh.
And that means that rules changes have usually always been bipartisan, and in fact almost universally and unanimously adopted. But there is an alternative, which has been proposed alternately by liberal Democrats in the 1950s and by conservative Republicans in the last decade, and that became known as the nuclear option, which was to force the majority leader, force the presiding officer to call the debate dilatory and call for a vote. And the senators would then appeal the ruling of the chair, and it would simply take a simple majority of the senators to do that, which means that at any moment, if you did that, the presiding officer could stop whatever filibuster, whatever debate was going on. That's something that both sides have considered, and they have both gotten to the edge of the cliff and just decided they really didn't want to jump. And in the 50s and in the more recent decade, they found sort of ways of not going detonating the nuclear option.
So,
but it's always possible that somebody could.
Really, both parties have an interest in the filibuster.
Mm-hmm. So, in that, just to kind of roughly sum up a couple of quick things, so that when people are talking about why the Senate is in gridlock, and how it did not used to be that way, they're really hearkening back to an era when you had really powerful Senate majority leaders like Lyndon Baines Johnson and others before him, who can rule the roost and move people around the way they want. It's more about a matter of that kind of politics than it is any change in the rules of the United States Senate.
There's also a big change in the American political parties. When Lyndon
That's
Johnson
huge.
Was
yep.
the majority leader, both parties were internally divided. You had conservative and liberal wings in both parties. Never did the conservative and liberal wing of the Democratic Party vote together. The conservatives in one party voted with the conservatives in the other. Liberals voted together. And Johnson could make these coalitions by pulling people in from the Republican side to vote with enough Democrats. Right now, we've got remarkable party discipline, internal cohesion, and lots of party line votes. But there's much less of a middle ground of those people who are willing to be the swing votes than there were in the 1950s when Johnson was operating.
That's a very powerful point. So I guess, Linda Monk, really what it comes down to is that Democrats will never really be able to move this unless the Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico become states.
Hey, you left out D.C. now.
D.C.,
Washington,
right.
D.C., and Guam.
Not that I'm necessarily in favor of statehood for D.C., but
Guam and the Marianas. Because
don't forget, D.C. has to pay taxes plus not get any.
That's right.
At least Puerto Rico doesn't have to pay income tax.
Well, this has been really illuminating.
I learned
a great deal. I really do deeply appreciate Donald Ritchie. It's great to have you on the show for the first time. I really learned a lot, and it's a pleasure to have you with us.
It was my pleasure.
Thank you so much. And our United States Senate historian, who's been there since 1976. And by the way, thank you for your service. You were a Marine during the Vietnam War, am I right?
I was a Marine, but I did not go to Vietnam. They sent me to Hawaii instead.
You're lucky, man. Okay. And Linda Monk, author of the words, "We Live By Your Annotated Guide to the Constitution." Thank you so much for being with us again. We look forward to having you on the air and coming in studio.
It's a pleasure. Mark.
Thanks,
as
Linda.
Always.
Anthony, I thank you both very much for being with us.
Thanks, Anthony.
Thank you all. And we're going to take a very brief break. When we come back, we're going to be joined by the panel and switch gears and talk about a little kind of weird local politics. Weird in the sense that all the machinations going on now inside the Baltimore City Council, which you know so well, Anthony McCarthy.
I do. But weird's a good word. There's a lot of very interesting inside baseball things happening.
So Anthony McCarthy and I will be joined by Julie Sharper from The Sun, Catalina Bird, who hosts a radio show called On Point, and Hassan Giordano, also a radio host, all of whom know local politics very well, will be in the studio. Stay with us. Don't go away. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Johns Hopkins Medicine. For the 19th consecutive year, the Johns Hopkins Hospital is ranked number one by U.S. News & World Report in their annual Best Hospital Survey. Find out more about the nation's top hospital at hopkinsmedicine.org. And Anthony McCarthy and I are joined by Julie Sharper, Baltimore Sun City Hall reporter, Catalina Byrd, host of On Point at WOLB, and Hassan Giordano, host of Reporters Roundtable and host of Speaking Right on the issue, to the issues, and the columnist for the Baltimore Examiner Online. And welcome to our show. Good to have you all with us.
Thank you.
Good to be with you.
And Julie and Hassan, you're both at City Hall?
Yep.
All right.
You're in the thick of it. So it's interesting to watch this. By the way, folks, we are going to have Mayor-designate Stephanie Rawlings-Blake on the program tomorrow with us. When Anthony and I get back from Annapolis, she'll be on the phone with us for about
30 minutes,
about half an hour of the show. So stay tuned for that, and we'll talk about that tomorrow. But right now, let's talk about what's going on in the city council. I said it was a really kind of a convoluted, strange process. And Julie, talk a bit about what you've been writing about in The Sun and what you've been hearing. I think the most disturbing part for most people is the kind of influence that people are beginning to unearth that is taking place on the outside to influence the nomination of Bill Cole.
Absolutely. And many council members said that they were very much disturbed by that sort of pressure, that was not something that they were accustomed to in this sort of race. I mean, it's basically a race that's decided by the 14 members of the city council when they appoint someone to replace the council president. And they were really surprised and really, frankly, not pleased to receive calls from developers, business leaders, fundraisers, asking them to support Bill Cole in the race when these were all council members who had already declared that they wanted to support Jack Young in his race for the council presidency.
Now, Julie, one of the things, then we'll go to Hassan. I think Hassan's with us. I hear him talking to somebody. Julie, there is one council member said that a very prominent developer who figured prominently in Mayor Sheila Dixon's trial actually spoke to them and said, we really like to see Bill Cole become the city council president. But he wasn't speaking on behalf of anyone other than himself, correct, as far as we know?
Well, that's a good question, Anthony. There has certainly been a lot of speculation that some of this pressure might be coming from Annapolis. I don't believe there's been anything direct that anyone has pointed out that would make that connection. But in private conversations, many council members have said that they feel like the ultimate source of this pressure might be Annapolis.
Hassan Giordano, I want to ask you, and then we'll bring Catalina Byrd into this conversation. There has been, the governor has outright said, I'm not involved in this process. But his fundraiser, Colleen Martin Lauer, has been calling council members, correct? And she's also Bill Cole's fundraiser.
She is, and actually Peter O'Malley is the treasurer for Bill Cole. But there have been individual reports from council members who have said that, yes, we've received either direct calls from Colleen Martin Lauer and Kim Washington, who is the chief of staff for Stephanie Rawlings-Blake, on behalf of Councilman Cole, or indirect calls that were coming from their behalf on as far as developers or business leaders who are also urging a support for Councilman Bill Cole. But tonight, to be quite honest, after talking with a lot of the council members here, doing another whip count and seeing the sentiment, most people are, I think, reserved to the fact that a Cole candidacy is no longer in the works, and so I wouldn't be surprised if the vote for Jack Young next Monday would be unanimous.
That's interesting. We might as well just go to another subject then. No, I'm just kidding. Catalina?
I'm still nervous. I won't believe it till I see it.
You're nervous about what?
About Jack getting the votes that he needs. We just know the power structure in our state. We know how it affects our city. And you can't count it till you have it.
Well, let's talk about the politics. What we think is going on here, then? I mean, and what it says about the nature of power and political power in the city. I mean, on the one hand, let me just outline something that you all can agree or disagree about for a second. That Stephanie Rawlings-Blake was instrumental in Martin O'Malley becoming mayor of the city of Baltimore. She helped convince her father, the late great Pete Rawlings, who was a very powerful political figure, to endorse Martin O'Malley for mayor in a campaign where the other two candidates were African-American men. And Martin O'Malley ended up with one-third of the African-American vote in this town and became mayor of Baltimore. And that caused a lot of consternation. Remember, there were all these demonstrations in the city, people leading demonstrations downtown against Martin O'Malley and against Pete Rawlings and all the rest. And that took place, and it caused kind of a bit of a divide in this town. And then you have what happened to Sheila Dixon. Stephanie Rawlings Blake going to move up to be mayor, clearly in many ways politically aligned with Mayor Martin O'Malley, as is Bill Cole, but with both the governor and with Elijah Cummings, who he worked for years. And then people, the rumor has it, I mean, the speculation is that there's the power centers around both those men are trying to help Bill Cole. On the other hand, you have something also people aren't talking about a great deal, which is that there's been a move afoot by a lot of local African-American elected leaders.
And non-elected leaders.
Saying we don't want somebody white to be president of the city council, that it needs to be somebody African-American. That part is in there. And then the final piece I'll just throw out here, we can just kind of wrestle with it all in a minute, is that the question remains, do you want a gadfly, which
Jack Young
could be, being independent of sorts, not part of that machine, or do you need somebody who's part of this political process to move the city forward? And that's part of the debate, and what would that mean? So, I mean, it seems to me it's that kind of complexity, but nobody's really talking about what any of it means for the future of the city. But we'll get to that in a minute.
But I think that's at the heart of what's in it for the city.
This is Catalina Byrd. Go ahead, Catalina.
That's at the heart of it, people's concern for the issue as what's good for the city, because we've already seen the city go one way under this established, already operating regime. And we want someone as our city council president that's not going to necessarily rubber stamp everything that this administration hands down. It's not guaranteed to be what's best for the city because they say it is. And that's where all of this has stemmed from. I truly believe is more so not a concern for whether it's an African-American or a white person so much as it is how in tune are they going to be with what it is that she wants to do as mayor, how it will affect O'Malley when it's time to run for re-election. They're looking at a bleak turnout in terms of his own party's lining against him. This is a last-ditch ask for control.
There's also a question of experience in my conversations with city council members. I mean, they bring up time and time again that Jack Young has been on the council since 1996. Bill Cole is a freshman. He was elected in 2007, and he does have past political experience. But, a lot of them will say beyond these complicated issues, there's a pretty simple issue of you have someone who's done his time and really, worked for years on the council and someone who's a relative newcomer.
Hassan Giordano, do you think that race is playing a part at all? There was a letter from the city delegation, the senators, encouraging the council members to support Jack Young. Some people said that, race is playing a role in this. I think Julie's right. There is this obvious factor that Jack Young has been there much longer.
Well, I think it plays a few parts. First of all, race, I think in a public's mind, is playing a big part of it. But I think in a councilman's mind, it's more of support for Jack Young, his tenure, his leadership. Most people forget that when Mayor Dixon was then city council president in the sense to the mayorship when Martin O'Malley became governor, Jack Young could arguably had the votes to become the next president to succeed Mayor Dixon at that time. He was told to back down, in which he did, and allowed Stephanie Rawlings Blake and gave all his votes to Stephanie to become the president at that time. So he's already, like I said, been in the forefront of taking on this mantle in 2006. So his colleagues have supported him since then, and they continue to do such. And I think that it goes beyond just race. It goes to, just tenure and leadership. But some people will say it's a race thing because the governor is seemingly trying to control Baltimore politics, and obviously he would like somebody running
the show down here for him that looks like him.
I want to ask all of you, and then, you know, we can move into some of the, I think there are some ramifications, and I think Catalina touched on it, but we can go deeper about what it does mean if Jack Young is elected, what it does mean for the coalition that Martin O'Malley is going to need to turn out in the city to ensure his reelection. I do want to ask you, however, about how do you think, and we'll start with Catalina and then go to Julie and then Hassan, how do you think, Catalina, that this whole idea that Jack Young stepped aside already, but there are members of the council who say, look, things have worked better when Sheila Dixon worked with Martin O'Malley. Things have worked better when other council presidents worked with the mayor. They got things done. If you have an independent president of the city council who is checking the mayor on everything he or she does, then it is kind of gridlock. The things that Mark and I were talking in the last segment about the Senate, that it does work better when Sheila Dixon worked with Martin O'Malley as opposed to Lawrence Bell, who threw bombs at Kurt Schmoak, or Mary Pat Clark, who worked against Kurt Schmoak, that the city does seem to move better. Wouldn't it be better for Stephanie Rollins, who we found out, despite what she was saying, was lobbying her colleagues to support Jack Young?
I think that's a twofold answer, because while it did work out better for the city when she worked with Martin, I think that what she did once she was the mayor proved that there were plenty of things that she just didn't have the power to get done. And so if you have that lock and toe, anybody that's in political in the political realm knows the importance of working together to keep your position. But I think she was truly just biding her time and doing the people of Baltimore what she had to do as their city council president until she could do the things that she did as mayor. And those things are a direct reflection of the difference between the type of leadership that we had under Martin O'Malley and Sheila Dixon.
But what do you think, Julie? What about this idea? Stephanie worked very closely with Sheila Dixon. Sheila Dixon worked very closely with Martin O'Malley. We've seen a huge drop in crime. We've seen businesses, small businesses being protected. We've seen a cleaner, greener city because the mayor's agenda was pushed by the president.
Well, I think many people on the council would speak to a great deal of conflict that has existed between the council president and the mayor in the past couple years. Once the Mayor Dixon's legal troubles came to the forefront, I think, you know, there was really sort of a chilling of the relationship between the mayor and the council president. So some would argue that if you looked at, you know, what the city business in the past year or so, there have been, you know, quite a number of bills that have been passed. There hasn't been a sense of gridlock, and yet you haven't had a mayor and a council president who worked hand in hand. I think we need to approach this with an open mind. Just because the council president and the mayor aren't necessarily the tightest
Good
of
point.
Allies,
Good
that
point.
Doesn't
mm-hmm.
mean that it's going to be completely a politics game and they'll just be shooting each other down. I mean, there is a chance, perhaps I'm being overly optimistic, but perhaps, you know, perhaps we will have sort of a system of checks and balances in place more than we would have if the council president and the mayor are very closely allied.
Now, just picking up on that, one of the things you wrote about Hassan Giordano in your blog yesterday, the day before, I forget which day it was, but you talked about the vote on the city council to change the makeup of the Board of Estimates, right?
Yeah.
Let's talk about how that affects where the city will be and the role a Jack Young would play on that versus a Bill Cole, and if that was to come to fruition.
I would address two points. First of all, Jack Young has personally said to me, I'm sure will say to you on the show or anybody else, that it's not about bucking Stephanie when she becomes the mayor and he's the city council president, that he will work, you know, with her to get things done for the city, but of course oppose her at times. But I think when it comes to the Board of Estimates, currently we have a makeup of five members, three of them being elected, and that's the comptroller, city council president, the mayor, and then two appointees of the mayor. Mm-hmm. So everybody knows it's always been the mayor's control. When you walk into the meeting, she has two appointees, who is the director of public works as well as the
city solicitor.
City solicitor.
And so she has 3 of the 5 votes she needs for anything she needs done. Well, what this bill would do is just leave it to 3 people, the elected officials we put in place. And so that what that'll do is take the power away from the mayor. And so there's 7 council members who are in support of this. Of course, Councilwoman Melinda Conway introduced it. It's been talked about for years, but nobody thought that they had enough votes to get it passed. Of course, Councilman Young is in support of it. I wouldn't be surprised if he took office as the president and put a little bit of pressure on some of the council colleagues that he has in his corner to say, we need to pass this. They need 10 votes to pass it veto-proof out of the council. And that way, Stephanie Rawlings-Blake, who is opposed to it becoming the new mayor, doesn't have any power of veto then. It will go straight to the people. And then the people would have the opportunity to vote on it in the November election.
410-319-8888. Let me ask you all a question. Do you care who's city council president? I'm just curious what's your thoughts out there about where this is taking the city of Baltimore and what this political debate might mean and what dynamic you'd like to see in the city council. You've seen some of the arguments, especially by Julie Sharper in the paper and Hassan Giordano in his blog. Kathleen Bird in her show have talked about it. Anthony's talked about in his show about this race for city council president and how important or not important you see that for the city of Baltimore. 410-319-8888. Anthony McCarthy and I are joined by Julie Sharper, who's Baltimore Sun City Hall reporter. Kathleen Bird, host of On the Point on WOLB. Hassan Giordano, who's host of the Reporters Roundtable and host of Speaking Right to the Issues on WOLB and columnist for the Baltimore Examiner Online. 410-319-8888 is the number here. We'll come to these calls coming. I'm curious what you think about how all this affects the future of our city and if it means that much. I mean, does it mean that much?
Yes.
In terms of it does. Why does it? Was that you saying yes, Kevin?
Yes. Okay. It not only means that much to the city of Baltimore, but the residents have to look beyond their city and understand that what the political ramifications of this are going into a gubernatorial election. And you have to win Baltimore City, PG, and Montgomery County to win the state. If he can't control this atmosphere here, a reelection is not guaranteed. And like I already said, his party is all over the place with talks of Wayne Curry, Doug Duncan.
That's the next hour.
All kinds of people. So we need people. They have to pay attention beyond just the city, even if they don't understand fully what a city council president does. Understand the ramifications going forward.
And I think that, Mark, that's such a very important question because I think a lot of people, there were polls that were done by The Sun prior to Stephanie Rawlings-Blake being put in the position where she knew she was going to become mayor, where a lot of people said they didn't know who she was and they didn't know what her priorities were and they really didn't know what the city council president does. They're very familiar with the mayor's office. They're very familiar with the powers of the mayor's office. But I'm telling you, as someone who has worked for a city council president and worked for a mayor, I know that city council president can be a roadblock. Ultimately, the mayor has power. But the city council president can really put a monkey wrench in the works of the city when it comes to the budget, when it comes to appointments, when it comes to a lot of things. Ultimately, the mayor has the power to go around a lot of the obstacles of the city council. But it's very important who sits in that position, if for no other reason than we see right now. Stephanie Rawlings-Blake is becoming mayor because we are losing the current mayor. And so it's very significant for the citizens who sits in that position because that person could be, through a whole series of things, become the mayor, the chief executive of our city, which is a billion-dollar corporation. So it's very important who sits in that position.
Hassan, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just saying, Mark, bottom line is people's pocketbooks are hurt right now. So we're looking at an economic crisis. So it's very particular in who leads our city. Now, of course, there's going to be probably tax increases in the city of Baltimore. We're facing a deficit. Now, a person like Bernard Jack Young, the councilman, he was the chair of the Budget and Appropriations. He's already said that he's opposed to any property tax increase. Now, so if you have a mayor that's, if you remember last year, him and Stephanie Rawlings-Blake were instrumental in holding up Mayor Dixon's budget, reworking it, and then sending out the budget that they wanted, the council wanted, and felt was best for the citizens of the city. So this year, especially this year and next year coming, with the economic crisis we're in, it is vital that we have good leadership at the top of the ticket.
Let me, before we bring Julie Sharper back in, get to the phones here, 410-319-8888. Some people have called in and left impatiently, didn't get on fast enough. Call back at 410-319-8888. I want to get your thoughts in the air about the city of Baltimore. We have about to have a new president, a new mayor of the city and president of city council. And by the way, Stephanie Rawlings-Blake will be on the show tomorrow with Anthony and I at 5:30. Let's go to Gaynor in Baltimore. You're on the air.
Hello?
Hi, Gaynor. You're on the air.
Hi.
Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you. I was just calling to say that if the person that the majority of the city council want to vote for, I think that they know him and they know the city and how things are run. I think we should go with what the city council wants. And sometimes it's better to have someone who has their own opinion as opposed to someone who is already going to, seemingly it appears, to vote the way the mayor would want them, the mayor-to-be would want them to vote on different issues.
Gaynor, thanks so much. And appreciate the thought and the ideas. Julie, I wonder if you're watching the city council also agree this is pretty much of a done deal at this point, that we're not going to believe that Bill Cole has not much of a chance here.
Well, from the very beginning, before, you know, even the mayor's plea deal was announced, it was pretty widely accepted that Councilman Young had 10 votes and that Councilman Cole had 3 votes, maybe 4. Those numbers have not changed. I was talking with some council members today who were saying, you know, sort of recounting the saga and you know, going over with it with me and saying, you know, from the day that Dixon's resignation was announced to last week when, you know, the newspapers really started jumping on the story, you know, blogs were writing about this, until today, there just haven't been any changes. I think it's pretty much been a done deal. I think that what's been going on now behind the scenes is a lot of negotiation in terms of who is going to be in charge of which committees, you know, and those sort of discussions are really being played out at this point.
I'm going to go back to the phones here, and I'll kind of throw out all four of you. Does this mean that Bill Cole shoots himself in the foot for his own political powers? Is it just the opposite in how we play the game in Baltimore City and who gets what? But 410-319-8888, Darnell, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
Well, Darnell, welcome.
I just wanted to say that being that this is a very pivotal time and in Baltimore politics, me, myself, and I'm just really getting into the, you know, really what Baltimore politics is as far as who's on the board of estimates and what the city councilman does and everything. And it seems to me like at this particular time, the agendas of some politicians are not for the city of Baltimore residents. And it just seems like they're trying to push their own person to try to get their own agenda when it doesn't seem like everybody's looking out for the residents. And me just getting into it, I'm kind of like flabbergasted to say, you know, this is a time where you could take a beacon of just leadership into taking Baltimore another spot, but it just seems like people are missing the ball with this and want to put their own person in to try to get their own agendas, I guess, to try to get reelected or to get, you know, get elected again. And it's kind of, you know, it's kind of sad right now that you know, what I'm hearing and what I'm reading.
Well, I would think that probably the governor, Martin O'Malley, and the city council president, soon to be mayor, Stephanie Rawlings-Blake, if they were even to publicly express a preference for Bill Cole, would argue that they are looking out for the best interests of the city. Unless this idea that there's something sinister about their support of Bill Cole. I mean, we have to be very honest about Jack Young has been on the council for 12 years, chair of two of the most powerful committees, and has a great deal of pull with his colleagues. But Bill Cole brings a very impressive resume to the Baltimore City Council, including having served in the Maryland General Assembly and having been a district director for Congressman Elijah Cummings. He's worked very closely with this congressman, as well as worked in the legislature. And, I mean, anyone who lives in his district, and I live in his district, will tell you that constituent services are at an all-time high in Bill Cole's office. Now, if you want to be elected president of the council or you have an agenda to run for higher office, you better answer your constituents' complaints and do it very well. But he has proven himself in a very short term to be a very active council member, and Stephanie Rawlings really relies on him. She has appointed him to look at the economics of the city. She's appointed him to look at some of the agencies in this transition. And to his credit, I mean, Bill Cole has done a really good job at ingratiating himself into the life of this council.
But Anthony, listen to what you said.
Hassan Jordan.
This is the main key. Is yeah, he might have a resume before that, but he's a freshman legislator with 2 years of experience at City Hall. And you're transgressing into the most powerful position at City Hall. Mm-hmm. Who would you rather have? Somebody with 12 years or 2 years? Now, look, fine, your resume is good, and I don't doubt that you can do the job. Well, then run and allow the people to vote for you 18 months down the line. Mm-hmm. But right now, your colleagues have to put somebody in place that can take the job and know what they're doing from day one. That means Monday, or it'll be Tuesday, February 9th, and be able to run with that mantle. Who is better to take that position right now? It has to be Jack Young.
But Hassan, it's not my job to make that determination. So I can't make the determination that Jack Young would be better. No, you can do that, but I can't. And that's why, no, and honestly, that's why I agree with a lot of the points you make, but I'm saying that we can't discount that Bill Cole could not actually take the mantle on Tuesday and move this council forward.
And I think that Darnell made a better point in the fact that people who are not in the know about politics, they come in and they look for the first time and they don't understand it. First and foremost, Darnell, if you're still listening, every politician says it's for the people, okay? For you to sit there and tell me that Bill Cole has made his presence known in the 11th District, well, of course, because clearly nobody says, oh, that's all I ever want to be as a city council person. There are some people that are in this arena because it is a profession. It is not about the people, and it is up to the people. They're ambitious, and it is up to the people to do their research. You can't take their word for it. Go and find out what they really stand on, because they'll tell you, I'm not going to vote for this on camera, on the air, and then they'll go in that closed room where you could have gone to the meeting because it's open to the public and vote differently. Hold them accountable. That's the most important thing. Don't listen to what they're saying. Watch what they do. Watch who they align themselves with. There's so much more that can be seen when you look at this as a game. It's chess at the end of the day, and somebody is going to end up being a pawn, and sadly in Baltimore, most of the time those pawns are us.
I was going to go to the phones here, but we haven't come through. We'll get these calls coming in just a minute, 410-319-8888. I'm curious, especially as we come back from a break in a couple of minutes here, what we think the difference will be between a Rawlings-Young world as opposed to a Dixon-Rawlings world in the city of Baltimore, and where that will take us when you look at what's kind of come up for the Board of Estimates, the issues of taxes, relationship with the police department, and all the rest. And I think that those are the issues that really are we really have to kind of wrestle with to see what we think. It's a little speculation when we come back. Do we have time for one quick call before we hit the – yes, we do. Let's go to Shirley. Quick thought before we go to break. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, Shirley. You're on the air.
Yes. I disagree with what Anthony McCartney just stated as far as the qualification of Cole versus Young.
Mm-hmm.
I think we live in Baltimore City. We do not know what Mr. Cole's real qualifications is, but we do know what Jack Young, most of us who vote and know the government know that. And I just don't understand. I'm a little surprised at the statement that you just made. What is the qualifications? Why don't we know about them?
Maybe one of the reasons you don't know about him, and you have to speak for yourself, because I think a lot of people do know about him, is that he represents the 11th district, and maybe you don't live in his district. But I think if we looked at the actual charter qualifications, it doesn't take a lot to meet that threshold. Now, as Hassan said, and Julie, there is a majority of city council members who obviously have made the judgment call that Jack Young can and should be their leader. But my point is, you can't discount Bill Cole or his qualifications, because he's more than qualified to be president of the city council. And of course, you may disagree with that. I appreciate your opinion, and I'm glad that you disagree with me. But my position is on point.
And I think that the charter is very clear that they do not even have to pick somebody
on the council. They could choose anyone.
Let's take a very quick
break. They could choose Mark Steiner.
I don't think so. I doubt that would ever happen. Okay, we're going to take a break on that one. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorders Center, providing clinical research trials that evaluate new therapies and the latest treatment options, including surgical intervention for advanced stages of disease. The number for more information is 1-800-492-4900. 5538. Our guests will return in just a minute as we continue to explore what the next step for Baltimore City will be. Stay with us.